Okay, so let's just start with some background biographical information. I noticed on your CV that you were born in Indiana. Did you grow up there?
Yes, I grew up in Hobart, Indiana. I was born in Gary, Indiana.
Okay.
Famous music fan city.
Okay.
But I grew up in Hobart, which was then a very small town. My father worked in Gary for U.S. Steel.
Okay.
And my parents moved there when he came to work there, I guess about a year before I was born. Anyway, they were in the process of building a house. And they were both from Boston, so they built a Cape Cod, a brick Cape Cod house with a lot of details that were very authentic. They got bullseye glass, and they had a, I forget what you call it, but it's a curved roof rather than straight angle to give the second floor a little more space.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, and you know, the family kept the plans for this house for a long time. In fact, I think I probably still have them in the basement.
Oh, that's
because it
neat.
Was sort of an achievement of theirs, you know, that mm-hmm. they recreated, in a sense, their world of the Boston and Cape Cod in the Midwest. And anyway, we lived there till I was 8.
Okay, so you were born in that.
Yeah, I was, I think the house was finished just about when I was born.
Which was 1939?
Right. So it was close anyway. And I have an older sister who's 4 years older.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the house I grew up in until I was 8.
And then you moved to Hobart?
That is Hobart.
Oh, that is Hobart.
Yeah, I was
okay.
born in that
born
Mercy
in
Hospital in Gary.
Oh, okay, okay.
The house
the
was
house
built
in Hobart.
Hobart. And then my father got interested in trying some new professional opportunities. He went to work for Webcor, which was one of the first tape recorder. It was a wire recorder company.
Oh, wow.
That was when I was 8 or 9, so it would have been 1947 or so after the war. You know. And so this was up in Chicago, so we moved to Arlington Heights. And we lived in Arlington Heights for about 6 months, but the Webcor adventure didn't work out, so we went back to work for Inland Steel in Indiana Harbor, Indiana, and then we moved back to Hammond. So
okay.
From the time I was 9 or 10, it was a year and a half or so, and they were moving. But I think I was still only 9 when we moved to Hammond, and then I lived there as long as I was living at home.
And so you went to school in Hammond then for?
I went to Bishop Noel High School.
Okay.
I went to St. Joseph's Grade School and Bishop Noel High School. And Bishop Noel was a big co-ed Catholic high school.
Okay. And so then what year did you graduate from high school?
I think it was 57.
Okay.
I think the Lord had a little.
Right. So when you were going to school, did you have ideas about what kind of career you wanted to have? Or
well, actually, when I was in elementary school, I had this idea that I should be a nun when I was in the 8th grade. And my parents were not very enthusiastic about that. The Sisters of Providence, who taught in the elementary school where I went, had a program for high school that was sort of a pre-novitiate, I forget what they called it, but anyway, it was for young women. And you could go to St. Mary of the Woods in Terre Haute, Indiana,
okay.
go to high school and then enter the order. But my parents were really not in favor of that, so they said, well, if I still wanted to do it after I finished high school, I could enter a community, but I couldn't go away. For high school.
Okay.
So I went to Bishop Noel. And you know, I always liked academics. I didn't so much have an idea that I would be a professor, although my mother was a teacher, so the
she
idea
was.
Of being a teacher was always a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a lot of times it was like, I'm not going to do it because I'm not going to be like my mother.
Right.
It was always a possibility. So, and then when I finished high school in 57, I wasn't that interested in joining a community. So I went to school, and I went to Northwestern for a year, which was a very interesting experience. It was, I mean, I was pretty homesick. It was the first time I'd really been away from home. So that was, you know, when you're the first year student. And, but it wasn't so far, so I could, you know, like take the train. And so I did that for the first quarter. We were in quarters. They still are in quarters. And then, you know, I got a little more acclimated and settled in. So I was okay. But one of the things I found was that I, it was really fairly secular, but it was also kind of anti-Catholic.
Northwestern.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I, you know, at the time, I that was sort of verified beyond my experience. But there was, partly it was the sort of secular character of it that, but the particular group that was sort of not intellectually, you know, aware would be Catholics, because they were still sort of dominated by these religious precepts and thinking freely. And that bothered me. I mean, I didn't totally agree with it. I wasn't like, oh, well, good, this allows me to get rid of my tradition. But I was very aware of the fact that I didn't know the answer. I didn't know how to respond to this kind of criticism.
Because, do you think that was partly because you grew up going to Catholic schools, or was it just...
Well, it was, but I also think that, I mean, I knew a lot, but I didn't know really, I mean, I hadn't really met this kind of intellectual critique of Catholicism.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Before. So, I mean, I had, within Catholicism, I hadn't been indoctrinated in a really rigid way. I wasn't a, I was very thoughtful, and I was educated in a way to be very thoughtful about religion. My parents were kind of anti-clerical in the sense that they were both very well educated, and they were not too enthused about some of the ideas of the priests or the nuns in the school. And, you know. So they would, you know, kind of balance that off a little bit and say, well, you know, you should respect your teachers, but they were enamored of all the religious overlay of some things. Anyway, so I wasn't, you know, I was educated in an atmosphere that accepted intellectual criticism, but I just didn't know the arguments.
Okay.
You know, as a first-year college student. And so I thought, well, I better go, before I decide that, you know, this criticism of Catholicism is valid, I better go and find out what the Catholics say, you know, and figure out what it is that you say to all this. So then I transferred to St. Louis University.
And that's a Catholic university?
Yeah, that's a Jesuit school.
Okay.
My father had gone to Holy Cross, so he was pretty big on the Jesuits. And, so I went there for a year, and then I sort of did decide to pursue this religious vocation. So the BBMs had a high school sort of on the campus of St. Louis University. It was independent, but you had to walk past it if you were going to classes. It was right in the middle. And my sister went to Clark College, my older sister.
Oh, she did. And that's a BBM school,
Yeah, it's
right?
a BBM school in Iowa. Actually, my youngest sister also went there, so both ends of the family went to Clark. But the sisters who taught her were very impressive to her and to the family.
Okay.
The intellectual tradition was really very admirable. So when I then was thinking about it, it was by that time I was in college, and I was pretty interested in, you know, academics. And
So partially then, so you, the first time you learned about the BVMs, was that when your older sister was at Clark?
Yes.
Okay.
So I was, so I inquired.
Okay.
And they had this high school, so I met some of the sisters there. And then Sister Mary Philippa, who had been an advisor to my sister, who was an English major at Clark, what had now come to Mundelein, in this would have been 59.
Okay.
And so when I came back to Hammond, and then had to kind of make the formal arrangements, Sister Mary Philippa was the person who met me and sort of recommended me, because she knew my sister, and so I made that connection.
Okay.
So I never went to school to BBMs or really knew them, except through my sister.
Through your sister.
Okay. I entered in 1959.
Okay. Now, so when you were at Northwestern and at St. Louis, were you studying history?
Yes.
Okay.
But I was also studying sort of core courses.
Other things, so, right, yeah. Here. Okay. So then Sister Mary Philippa, it arranged for you. How does that work? She arranged for you to take...
You know, I can't remember all the details, but you have to, you have to apply and be accepted. And in order to apply, you have to have a member of the community
recommend
you. So that's what she did. And you have to write a letter, and then there are certain rules that the church has about, you know, who can enter. I don't know if those have changed at all. You have to be in good health, and I'm pretty sure you have to be a virgin. I think if you are married, or if you, you know, then they make an exception. I'm not really sure, but there, you know,
there are
canon laws about this.
Okay.
Not so much that religious communities sort of individually say that, they might anyway, but they have to follow this. So you have to verify all these things. It's kind of like, you know, entering any institution, you have to have a medical exam. And then you get a list of all the things you have to bring. So you have to go to the suppliers of, you know, kind of institutional garments and stuff, and you have to get so much underwear and so many black blouses and so much fabric, and, you know, and you get a trunk, a big trunk, like a 36-inch steamer trunk that you put your stuff in. And then you're, you know, when you're in the community and when you move from place to place, everything goes in the trunk.
Okay.
And you're supposed to limit your acquisitions, you know,
to the trunk.
It can go in the trunk.
Oh, okay.
And that gets moved around. So anyway, when you enter, you know, you buy these clothes and shoes and stuff, and then you put them in the trunk, and those are your supplies.
Mm-hmm. So when you, what was it then about the BVMs that appealed to you? Was it there, and was it that they were respected intellectually?
Yes.
Yes. And what was,
well, the other thing that happened in terms of service, well, they were educators.
Okay.
They didn't have any other work.
Okay.
And by that time, it was clear that education would probably be a good place for me.
Okay.
Not nursing, not social work. You know? So that idea that they were very good educators, and that education was probably a field that I was suited for. So that seemed like a good match, that I would do something that I was able to do. And then in 1958, there was a terrible fire in Chicago at Our Lady of Angels grade school, and a lot of children were killed in the fire, and three sisters. And there was sort of a sense, I remember I had, that, you know, well, there's this sense of needing to replace sisters who died, or a sense of, you know, serving in a place where you're needed. So it was kind of an element of the idea of doing good work, doing service in education, and here was a community that did education and that, you know, needed numbers. Now when I entered, it was a group, I think we were 118.
Okay, when you took, is it called taking your vows, or?
Well, that's several steps.
Okay.
When you enter, you're called a postulant. And for 6 months, you're kind of educated in what you're going to take on. And then you're received into the community and you become a novice.
Okay.
And that's when you get the habit.
All right.
And then for 2 years, you're a novice. Right? 1 year, you study only theology and canon law, you know, religious subjects.
Okay.
And the and then the second year, you continue your studies about religious life, but you also do college courses.
Okay.
And so it's a 2.5 year training before you take your first vows.
Okay.
And so you, yeah.
And did that all take place at Clark College then?
No, that took place at Mount Carmel in Dubuque.
Okay.
Same city, but it's the mother house. It's in a different location, but as postulants, we took college courses, and then as second-year novices, and the faculty would come over from Clark to teach us.
All right.
So in that sense, I was a student at Clark,
sort
of a year when I was in Dubuque.
Okay.
And then after I took my first vows, because I was now like almost a senior mm-hmm. in college, because I'd had 2 years, and then I had some while I was a novice, I was sent directly to Mundelein, to what was called the Scholasticate. It's now the Wright Hall across the street from Mundelein, where a lot of retired sisters live. But at that time, it was for young sisters who were going to go to finish college at Mundelein, because in the religious communities in the 50s, they made a decision to educate young women before they went into the classroom. The tradition had been you go to the classroom, you go to summer school until you get your degree.
Okay.
But the decision was made in the middle 50s that young people entering, not just the BBMs, but other communities too, would be educated before they went into their work.
Okay.
So the BBMs had a range then that members, young members, would go to Chicago, and they would live across the street from Mundelein, and they would attend classes there. So I was sent in January of 62, I think.
To Mundelein.
To Mundelein. And I started, and then I graduated in June of 63.
Okay. So when you were, so you were still taking classes then at Mundelein when you were at the Scholastica?
Yes, I was a student.
You were a student.
As a member of the BBM.
And what was that like? What was the ratio of student? I mean, it was all women then, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, Anne Harrington has an essay in this new collection of essays we're going to bring out next year. And she talks about the experience of being a BBM student, you know, with the other students. We were pretty separate. I mean, it was, the classes were good, and but we were, by the time we were there, there seemed to be different views on how the young women who were sisters should relate to the other students. There was some concern that, you know, they not overwhelm the other students or make it look like a convent school or whatever.
Okay.
But there were various concerns about whether we young nuns should be kept separate because, you know, we'd get ideas that weren't appropriate, or whether we shouldn't associate so much because we shouldn't kind of dominate or intrude upon the college experience of the other students, so they would think it was a convent school mm-hmm. or something, you know. So it was on both sides, why should we not associate that much? But anyway, when I was there, the tradition was we shouldn't really associate. So it was pretty much we went across the street and went to class, and then we came home and studied. We didn't do a lot of activities. We did attend lectures or anything that was for students, but we didn't do a lot of clubs. Now some people who worked on the newspaper or the literary magazine were a little more involved. I wasn't doing that, so. You know, it was a good relationship, but I really didn't know the students that well. Mm-hmm.
And was it, when you said there were different views, was that different views of the administration or the leaders among the BBMs sort of came up with this?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know all the details, but it was, it was a new thing to work out.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as I said, there were 118 of us when we entered. I think there were only about 80-some. Took first vows.
And that was, and so would you have taken your first vows then in 19, what was that, 1959 or 1960? Or I guess it would be 61.
Yeah, I entered in 59, so 60, I was a junior novice, 61, I was a senior novice. And so I would have taken them, we took them in on February 2nd, and so that would have been, I think, in 62.
Okay. And then is there a second vows or a final vows?
Yes, final vows are 5 years later.
Okay. So where did you take final vows then? Was that
actually, that was a, I finished at Mundelein, and then I taught at Mundelein, went to Loyola for a little while, and then I was very unhappy. That was a very difficult transition from being a student. I was made the secretary to the superior. The BBMs had split the president of the college and the superior of the community.
Oh, okay.
In around that time. And so Sister Anita was the president, but Sister Mary Emily Flynn was the superior of the sisters. And so I was then the youngest, you know, person, at least as a BBM, probably in age too at that time. So I had a room on the ninth floor next to Sister Emily's, and I was to sort of look after her room and her clothes and sort of be assist. And I was to teach a Western Civ course and go to Loyola to graduate school and handle the mail for the college.
Oh, geez, you had a lot of things.
Well, it was a lot of things, and, you know, and but it also created a schedule for me where I never was with the community.
So you were more...
I was really on my own, yeah. Because I was going to school, so it meant I never had dinner with the community, and we had silence at breakfast, so it wasn't as if you were, you know, so the time when you would really see people, I wasn't there, and then I had to put the mail out, so that was kind of an evening schedule, so anyway, I was incredibly lonely. And then, of course, just, I think I probably was depressed. I sat in the front pew because we were in pews by order of, in the community.
Okay.
With the senior people in the back and the youngest people in the front. So I sat in the front pew and I would, you know, I would be in tears every morning, sniffling away, trying to say my prayers. So I finally said, you know, I don't think I'm able to do this. I'm so upset all the time, and, you know. So then I was sent to teach high school in Fort Dodge, Iowa, which I did for 6 months, I mean, for the second semester. And that was okay. I mean, again, it was a nice group of women, and I, you know, I was able to do it, and so
and
it
you
was
were,
sort of a more settled life.
You had more contact with other sisters that
right,
way.
Right. But by the end of that year, the BBMs had established a new novitiate in California, Los Gatos, south of San Jose, in Santa Cruz Mountains. Beautiful place. Big new building up on the hill. And the land had come with a big house that was up on the hill with a swimming pool. It's a gorgeous place. And but they needed sisters to teach these young women who were going to enter the community, because so many were entering.
Okay.
So ironic, you know, that this is
in the 60s.
In the early 60s, and 4 years later is the collapse. But in 64, the numbers were so large, you know, they built a whole new division, and by 68 and 69, it was just a collapse. And anyway, so then I was chosen to go out there and teach novices and go to Stanford.
Okay.
So from 64 to 66, I went to California.
And were you teaching and going to school at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I got a master's degree at Stanford, and I was teaching. And there were lots of changes in the community then. And so, you know, I had to drive to Stanford.
And how far was that?
Oh, I don't know, maybe about 30 miles.
It was
really
nice. It wasn't too
drive
bad.
Okay. Through the plum orchards of Santa Clara when they were still plum orchards in February. It was so beautiful. And, of course, the Stanford campus is very much like a ranch. It's kind of a shaggy. But it's a, it was all new to me. California was all new to me. So that was very exciting. And of course it was very exciting to be in graduate school. And so I loved it. And then of course going in the summer, I was living on Stanford campus in the summer. And then I was commuting during the year. But in the summer, I would go home on the weekends to Guadalupe, and then, of course, because the swimming pool was there, we had a we could go swimming, and this gorgeous view down over the valley of San Jose. And the first summer I was there, I was jumping off the diving board, and I broke my foot.
So oh, no.
I ended up going back to Stanford with this big cast on my foot, all in habit and all, and so people were asking, how did you break your foot? Well, I broke it by, you know, falling off the diving board. So it was all this sort of, here I am swathed in black, you know, yards of surge, and then I'm saying I broke my foot on the diving board because I was swimming. And so the whole sort of new look at nuns and being young and in school, and it was very fun.
It was, now,
yeah, and so that was the other thing about the idea of sacrificing your life when you enter a religious community. And I'm thinking, well, I mean, it was a sacrifice, but when you really think about it, here I was going to Stanford, you know, having an opportunity that would have been a great thing in any case, you know, and living in this beautiful setting. With a swimming pool and all this, you know, very that I never could have afforded as a person, you know, but it came with the institution,
with the community.
They built the property, they built the. So it was a strange combination of intellectual stimulation and freedom in a very prestigious place, living in a place with a gorgeous house and a swimming pool. And, it was great. And we, as young, there were several other young nuns who were there, too. And we, of course, were all taken up with the Second Vatican Council and all the considerations of changing religious life, not wearing habits, you know, a new understanding of the vows and obedience and a new participation in making decisions. And, filing orders. And, and then it turned out that we were raising all these questions with the novices, so we were decided, it was decided we were a bad influence, so we weren't able to sit with the novices anymore. We had to sit apart.
But yet teach them.
Teach
but you were
them,
only
yes,
teaching them
socially.
Canon and, okay.
We were just teaching them academics.
Oh,
we
not
couldn't talk
socially.
About religious life with them because we had too many new and wild ideas. Which, so we. There was that atmosphere, you know. And then I had a good friend that I made at Stanford whom I invited down. And then that came up against the rules because we were then supposed to eat in the guest dining room because seculars couldn't come in and eat in the sisters' dining room.
Okay.
But it was very weird for me to say, you know, come and visit and then of course, we're isolated
keep it
up
separate.
Here, and you
yeah.
can't say, come and sit and meet the people. You know? So then some BBMs would come and have dinner with us in the guest dining room, but we couldn't do that. So that was, and that was a question for me. It's like, well, you know, what is this about hospitality to strangers when they have to be separate from us? And,
yeah.
You know, so it was just a time of a lot of new experiences. And the other experience that I had, and this was all sort of challenging, the rules, not the logic of them, you know. So I had two experiences that are along the line. One was that the rule was you couldn't be in the room with a man with the door closed. So I went to see an advisor at Stanford, and his office was right on the main thoroughfare, right inside. So the traffic of history student, anybody going in and out, was phenomenal. And so he always had his door closed. So I can remember going in to see him, and of course he's closing the door, and I'm thinking, oh.
No.
And I thought to myself, you know what? I think I better not say anything. I think I just better do more business than me.
Right.
So I didn't say, you have to leave the door open for me, you know, but then I had to sort of say that to the superior. It's like,
to tell her that that's
I thought it probably would be better not to say he had to open the door because, you know, really. So with those things, that's, you're in a different setting and you're like, well, I know this is the rule, but I don't think it applies here. You know? And then the other issue was, my introduction to social justice issues was through the farm workers, through Cesar Chavez.
Yeah.
And when I was there, he was starting a movement in Delano.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young doctor in San Jose. That was also the Great Society, and there was a Economic Opportunity Commission in San Jose that was getting going to try to address Great Society issues in San Jose, and the doctor was involved with that, and he invited some of the nuns to come to one of the breakfast meetings, and of course I was the youngest one there, and I was interested, but it was like no one else wanted to do it, so I got sent off to do it.
Okay.
Which interested me a lot. And then the doctor said he was concerned that, you know, these wonderful dedicated women ought to have their health checked, and so